many dollars a day they get for a nursing home?
Yeah.
I'd be interested. And that budget hasn't been finalized.
Oh, no, no, not at all. Representative Jones.
Yeah, John, the percentile, is it still at 70?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Jones, the percentile, the theoretical formula for funding is at the 75th percentile of approvable costs. That's the theory. That is not reality.
Well, I know that, but you remember last year,
yes,
John, they started at 60.
Yes.
And we were able to hold it to 75, which put such a burden on the private paying patients because the state won't pay their share.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that is the subject of a whole nother disagreement that our facilities have with a lot of people in this building right now, and that is what causes pay down of private paid patients, $300 to $400 a month in subsidy. When that problem's settled, we can work on another bill that's in another committee together. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay.
I'm a substitute analyst today, Mr. Chairman, but my experience with Fairview leads me to issue a warning that just changing the location of Medicaid regulations, licensing and regulation, won't necessarily change the standards. And the reason is that the federal government pays whoever does that job and will expect it to be done, I suspect, in very much the same way it's done now. So this should not be viewed as any easy out for nursing homes at all.
That is correct.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Wise.
I wanted to be on the Human Resources sub, but I didn't get there. But one of the things that really troubles me as an Oregonian is the federal government, under both congressional and presidential administration, that the newspapers, not just us Democrats, say is one of the more conservative, coming out and telling the state that we're not doing enough. There's an old saying, where there's smoke, there may be fire. I'm sure that a lot of it is their being arbitrary and officious and unreasonable and all those things that the federal government always is. And anybody who's telling you something you don't like usually is, particularly if it's the government. But underneath all that, is there some kernel there that the state of Oregon isn't quite carrying our share of the load?
When you compare expenditures per capita across the country on human resource services, you will find Oregon ranking in the 40s. It's somewhere a little better than Louisiana. Mr. Wilson. After hearing all that, do you think your division really wants all the complaints? Because you already get complaints. You're going to get probably all three, four times as many.
Right. I would agree with the analyst that this is not a panacea. It's not going to solve all of the problems. What we'll get for this will be, hopefully, at least consistency. And perhaps because of the fact that we have people in those nursing homes on a weekly basis already, a little better idea of what the true picture is. But sanctions for nursing homes are still going to occur. If we see bad patient care, and that's our opinion, we're going to call it that way. I think, on the other hand, though, it may make us put us in more of an advocacy position than we have been, where we can clearly see that the reimbursement isn't doing the job. So, but it ain't going to be easy. There have been several people who've told us that we're crazy for being in favor of this.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, everyone was very kind to the health division. I know Dr. Wright's in the room. He wasn't there at the period of time I'll refer to, but it was around 77, 70, I can't remember, Governor Straub. And when Christine Gebbie was hired, as the administrator, and one of the largest issues in the health division at that time was long-term care facilities. Legislature was filled with complaints and long hearings. There had been some patients moved from one nursing home in the Portland area, and some died. So it's not a new problem. And we had legislation that almost passed last session, and we had testimony that, well, they didn't really, DHR, take it very seriously until January. So I would issue a very large warning that you take these problems very seriously and that you work very closely with the advocacy groups, and that you report to the legislature.
We would be glad to do that.
Because you could stumble and fall terribly. You have a research unit.
Yes, we do.
Could you ask them to draft up, you know, some amendments to this bill that would, one, assure that the functions will be combined of inspection and monitoring and abuse investigation, which will try to integrate those to the fullest extent possible. That the regulatory criteria and the surveyor's interpretations be developed and implemented independent of any influence regarding any budgetary problems. And third, that the sanctions be applied in a proportional manner to the problem that exists. And to report periodically to the legislative review, whatever you call it, what's the word?
Agency.
As well as to the governor's commission on senior services. And if it would cost any money, let us know. So, kind of get at it. There was.
Did you say when do you want him to come back?
Periodically.
Well, would it be an appropriate addition to that to ask for some kind of a report on our level of effort or the general adequacy he finds of our effort in terms
yes.
of are the violations they are finding related to, in their opinion, to an inadequacy of funding or to a shortage of commitment on the part of the licensee to provide services that they should be able to afford within their
funding. So as a review on that, the part about the sanctions that they offer be proportionate, then also to look at the nature of the violations, see what causes them.
Yeah.
Is it a lack of resources, reimbursement, or is it a problem of management or neglect?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hannah.
To follow up on Senator Weiner's comment and your question and request, I think it might be appropriate if this subcommittee were to perhaps draft a letter to Senator Roberts, chairman of the Human Resources Committee, and request that this specifically be placed in your budget as a budget note, so that we have some direction for them to follow.
We will do that. It wouldn't be any objection to us doing that.
Just a question.
Yes, Reverend Jones.
I suppose that put your one sign to last by the governor would be the one that takes place. I think that's what the rules say. If it's spelled out in the bill, what they have to do. I see no problem with putting it on the budget note too, but Well, there were some things, I believe, Mr. Chairman, that you were asking.
There's some funding issues that are outside our area.
Outside of this bill, and it would be more appropriate if we were to direct that specifically to the other sub and request that it be included in the form of a budget note so that we can follow up on this. That's all I'm saying.
That'd be fine. This bill, I think, with amendments would require them coming probably every time the e-board reads, if they're talking about human resources, and they usually do, I would think. There'd be a little information about it, maybe not that often, maybe only four times.
Are you talking about amending the bill?
Yeah, oh yeah. I was going to put it in writing in law.
Well, if you did that.
Oh, yeah. These weren't budget. These were asking for amendments that we would then attach to this bill.
I misunderstood what you were doing then. Okay, I apologize.
Well, could I recommend Representative McCracken that it be four times during a biennium rather than each time?
Yeah, that would be all we'd require, though. You may well expect to be in, I would think.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Wise.
If we do that, wouldn't then an advocacy group be able to, as Senator Powell said, talk about all three branches of government with this agency, not with regard, this wouldn't give an advocacy group any leverage to say that inadequate funding is present, because that is the way you worded
that. No, that isn't the way it worded.
But it would give them leverage to say, we want you to look at whether the violations you're finding are caused by mismanagement, to use the most generic way of expressing that, or underfunding.
Okay.
I think we're running very close, Mr. Chairman, to setting yourself up for the financial liability for every nursing home in the state of Oregon.
Watch it, Senator.
I knew that was coming from my experience in the corrections budget. I would want to see that we didn't word it in such a way that somebody could sue and say, you've got to spend more money. But I think that if you worked at this right, you could get it worded so they had to begin to find out which it is. Now, if I could be shown that you can't do one without doing the other, then I would urge us not to do that, because obviously we don't want to invite a lawsuit saying we aren't spending enough money. That certainly is not what we're up to. But I wouldn't want to drop back from an effort to make them start looking at making a distinction, just because, you see, this is going to be politically difficult without anything about lawsuits saying that you're not spending enough money, because this puts him in the position of having to possibly come back and say you aren't spending enough money, which is going to set up a tension and bring things out of the closet that a lot of people would rather have go quietly by. Until I got up and made a comment, nobody was going to discuss $200 million worth of corrections budget being passed across the floor today. Oh, that's fine, you folks take care of that.
Well.
Right? Isn't that what was going on?
Let's hope we'll be quiet.
Yeah. Well, even when I got up, they just asked a couple little questions and voted unanimously, which is fine. It showed a great vote of confidence over our work, but sometimes let George worry about it. I don't know.
I like it when they're quiet in the house. which they are. What I had in mind was to try to clarify the issues that have been brought forward, and I didn't want to get legally entangled.
No.
It would seem to me that you must consider the adequacy of reimbursement when you come in your normal budgeting process,
As a matter of fact, Mr. Chairman, we have to make assurances to the federal government that our reimbursement mechanism reimburses the reasonable costs of efficiently and economically operating providers. So we could write a budget note that around that test that we have to make already.
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe what we ought to do is take a hand at drafting.
Just take it, yeah.
And work with legislative counsel. How soon would you want that?
Next Wednesday or so. We could have something that staff could look at. or even sooner if they could look at it.
Would that be heard separately?
I don't know. I'd have to talk to the co-chairs about what's to become of this bill. I think we might be talking about the health division and their money maybe Thursday, and at that time we might take some away. I don't know. But that might be. That's what I was thinking. Representative Jones.
I begin to get a little concerned on the floor. You mentioned that a while ago. If we don't flip up, it's going to take 2 days on one bill. You know, we got half to go.
If we don't do what?
I was illustrating this morning. I say if we don't speed up upstairs, it's going to take 2 sessions on one bill.
Not just the action on the floor, but there's committee problems. The bills that Ways and Means need are still in substantive committees, and we're going to have to try to work real hard because we'd like to go home. Okay, anybody else want to testify on this Senate Bill 463? Not, I'll close the public hearing and adjourn the subcommittee.
That's two whacks of the gavel.
Public Safety of the Joint Ways and Means Committee meeting, May 4th, 1987, 1:30 p.m., room H174.
Public Safety Subcommittee of Ways and Means will come to order and open the public hearing on House Bill 2333. And we have Corey Streisinger from the Governor's Office, along with Michael Franke, newly appointed head of the Corrections Division, which, if this bill should pass, would become the Department of Corrections. And this bill was introduced at the request of Neil Volchman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to introduce Michael Franke to members of the committee who have not already met him. As the chair pointed out, he is currently head of the Corrections Division, and we hope will be soon head of the Corrections Department. I'll let him briefly describe the bill to you. As the committee is probably aware, it has been passed out of the full Judiciary Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Jones.
Yeah, before we get started on that, I think she should read all of these repealers here.
Mr. Chair, if the chair really wants me to go through that, I'd be delighted.
No, thanks. It is just something to look at. A whole page of statutes that would be repealed.
Or amended.
And some repealed. Mr. Frank.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much for the opportunity to address you on House Bill 2333. This bill is a very straightforward change in status for the Corrections Division, making it a department. The change essentially is requested by the governor so that the director of the corrections function for the state of Oregon will report directly to him rather than through an umbrella agency head. It's quite a thick document, principally because it has to refer to all locations in existing law where the term corrections division or administrator of a division of the umbrella agency is referred to. However, it is a straightforward modification in that it does nothing else, either fiscally or administratively, than make that one change. The other elements that go along with that that may have some fiscal impact or other impact were pulled out and addressed separately. There were some other issues originally included that have been pulled out and addressed separately. So essentially the only issue before the committee with this bill is the issue of whether or not the division should be a department.
Representative Jones. Yeah, the question that I had in mind was, and I believe you already said it, but just want to make sure you give that it's fiscally neutral then as far as cost is.
Yes, sir. It's my understanding that since the first of this year, the division has essentially been functioning as an independent entity and not been involved with review of budget or other proposals or administrative function with the umbrella agency. And that, in fact, has a positive fiscal impact in the sense that there had historically been an assessment against the division by the oversight agency.
By the human resources. department, now that won't be there.
Yes, sir, that assessment, and I think it was over a quarter.
Is that your savings then?
Yes, sir, it was over a quarter of $1 million. And I believe that money has already been removed from the operating budget for the corrections agency.
Well, that's correct. But what they went ahead and did is increase the assessments to the other divisions in the Department of Human Resources to make up for the departure of the corrections division. So to the corrections division, it will appear as a savings. To us, it doesn't.
Well, the effect of that, Mr. Chairman, will undoubtedly be to improve the oversight over those other agencies.
Oh, right. I'm sure that was the argument. Will the division, newly formed as a department, have sufficient resources to function independently?
Yes, sir, I believe that it will. The division now has personnel function and business office function in the central office. In addition, it has a history of the institutions having staff to perform those functions. So I believe that the division is capable of walking on its own 2 feet.
Public relations?
We do have a single public relations officer, and he's quite busy. But I don't think we're going to burn him out. I think it's an important agency to have someone to interface with the media, because, especially with the governor's emphasis on corrections and with some of the issues that have to be resolved in the next 2 years.
Senator Hannon.
Mr. Frankie, I noticed one of the editorialists in the TV station in Portland the other night indicated that you had come to Oregon and studied our system. When you studied our system, was it based on this type of an approach of a corrections department versus a corrections division that you perhaps found needed to be changed, or the mode of correction needed to be changed?
No, sir. My previous contacts with Oregon involved me in spending some time in the institutions and dealing with the chief executives of those institutions. Quite frankly, I came here a couple of years ago to hire one of your wardens, and I was impressed with this system, and I'm still impressed with it. You have good people out there and stable institutional environment. At that time, I had no idea that the corrections function was being performed under an umbrella agency. I pretty much stuck to the penitentiary and to OSCI and was dealing with Hoyt Cupp and George Sullivan, either one or both of whom I would have happily hired, and I ended up with George Sullivan. I would have taken them both if they both wanted to come.
Did the system that you operated in New Mexico operate on the same concept of a department basically standing free on its own?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, yes, sir. In New Mexico, the governor has a cabinet form of government, and corrections is a cabinet agency. It also includes juvenile corrections, though, so it's slightly different from the system you have here in Oregon. It does include field services, which your system in Oregon has.
Would this move in any way symbolize a lack of emphasis on rehabilitation now that it's coming out of the Department of Human Resources, or in any way change the philosophy of Oregon's correction operation?
Mr. Chairman, I don't think there's anything implicit in the legislation that does that, and there's certainly nothing implicit either in Governor Gosar's philosophy or my own that would do that. I sincerely believe that if we have an opportunity to work with people who have a felony history in an institutional setting or in a community setting, and we don't try to do something constructive with them, then to a large extent we're accountable for their behavior afterwards. And so I believe in making a sincere effort to rehabilitate offenders.
Mr. Chair, might I respond briefly to that as well? The bill does contain a section on page 2 of the printed bill at the end of section 1 specifically requiring the new department to coordinate with the Department of Human Resources on those functions which Human Resources now performs to ensure that nothing is lost by this transformation.
Just for the record, the House of Representatives, through an interim committee, recommended this very same move. During the interim, former Governor Attia had appointed a task force to study the Department of Human Resources, and one of the recommendations was that it would be acceptable to go ahead and to make corrections a separate department. It was not an enthusiastic recommendation of the past administration, but it was there. Along with that was
the recommendation that juvenile corrections stay within the Department of Human Resources. And the argument that Governor Attia had used was that juvenile corrections were purely rehabilitative and should be seen as a human resource function. It's just for the record.
Representative Jones?
Yeah, I have one further question, and I asked it on the floor this morning, and I didn't get an answer. Of course, I didn't expect one. I'm still pursuing that, and that's the definition of what's minimum security. What's the definition? What do you have as the definition for minimum security facility?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Jones, a minimum security facility ordinarily is a facility with that does not maintain an active security perimeter. In other words, there is not a barrier between the institutional operation that exists for the purpose of keeping the inmates inside.
And to continue on that a little bit, they're more or less like a labor camp type of a thing. And of course, we have one of those down in the Tillamook area. And then, of course, the prison annex out here. And of course, the track record is not all that great as far as keeping them in there. And depending on where you put it, if you have to site one in Eastern Oregon, what would they do? I mean, you know, that's the problem with prisoners of any kind is idleness, you know, and without security, and they walk away. It's not a very nice thing to think about to have one of those in your community and have walked away at the rate of whatever, any rate.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Jones, it is part of the justification for minimum security that the individuals assigned to that security status don't need to be confined behind a barrier because they're not escape routes. But as you pointed out, from time to time, they wander off. Usually, those people are people who do not have ugly histories of criminal conduct, so that if they do wander off, usually they go home. Or they leave the state. But there are exceptions to that too, and those exceptions can be horrendous. The alternative to having minimum security space, if you want to override that escape concern, is to have secure space for those offenders. And I think, by and large, the cost isn't justified, because the cost to run a secure prison space is significantly higher.
I know, except that we shouldn't confuse the two issues of what we can afford, but what we need. And, you know, if a person has done something that he needs to be in jail, then he needs to be in jail. And so, you know, that's a point that I have a real problem with. And, you know, if you're just going to have somebody serve time on their honor, more or less, then maybe they shouldn't even be there. And I think this is important. And the walk away rate out here is not large, but then it does happen. And I don't know that that applies to the Tillamook camp down there, but I think that the fact of the matter, I'd about as soon have a maximum security prison with a high fence around it and charged with electricity than have a labor camp there with people wandering around all over the country. But then that's just my personal.
I think I would agree with you if I were in that community. The problem in some inmates' cases is that the individual never makes minimum security custody, but he finishes his time. And that kind of guy can go from medium or maximum security housing to the street. And that's a little scary. But minimum security, even if you know, you get past the problems of location and inmate activities, these people, there's a heavy turnover in prison population. This system sees a whole lot more people than its total population every year. And no matter what a person's done, at some point, usually he gets out. And minimum security is important, if for no other reason, to provide a decompression stage for a felon who is about to go to the community. So within his last 6 months, year, 2 years, if he's been in prison a long time, we need to start getting him ready to live on his own. And an objective of minimum security is to get people involved either in work programs or education programs in the community so that that person can decompress. It's very traumatic to go from a controlled environment of a prison setting to the street. In many instances, or in many ways, it's a lot harder to live in the community than it is to live in prison when you're a person who has poor impulse control. So minimum security can provide that sort of a staged interface back to the community.
Well, you know, I had to make those comments. I know that we've got some problems, and I intend to help do most of them, although this does bother me, so I voted no on Florida Day. I would vote no again if I had the chance again, but then I didn't hear it. Thank you, though.
Thank you, sir.
Representative Jones has highlighted a concern that was voiced by a number of members on the House floor today. And so probably one of the most controversial aspects of your job will be working with the siting task force around the minimum security facilities, defining those and gaining community acceptance for them. Sounds like it's going to be a real challenge.
Yes, sir, I would agree with that, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, is there anybody else? Representative Jones.
Now, are we, when they get to a certain point, and I'm sure they will be in that $12 million that's in the e-board, and if they
House Bill 2333 be further amended to include an emergency board, I mean an emergency clause, making the act effective upon passage.
Then the Senate could confirm.
You could move.
Section 247.
Right. Objections to that motion? Hearing none. Adopted. Senator Hannan moves House Bill 2333 as amended by the subcommittee to the full committee with a due-pass recommendation.
Mr. Chairman, could I ask for one?
Sure.
Since this is a House bill and we don't like it over the Senate side, I would also move that prior to its arrival on the floor that it be printed engrossed as amended by our subcommittee. We don't like the versions that the House sends over to us as
we don't like it either.
So I'd like to, for that reason, I think that we should have it properly printed.
Amended too. Senator Hannan's motion includes instructions that it be printed, be engrossed.
We send them over that way purposely.
Yeah.
Divide and conquer, I know.
And it's funny to get up and argue about things that have been resolved in amendments that they haven't figured out. Objections to Senator Hannan's motion? Hearing none. So ordered. There being no further business to come before the subcommittee, will adjourn until tomorrow. Right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Safety of the Joint Ways and Means Committee meeting, May 5th, 1987, 1:30 p.m., room H174.
It's all right.
Public Safety Subcommittee will come to order. I would like the committee to bring back House Bill 2333, which established the Department of Corrections. You recall yesterday we hastily added an emergency clause, making it effective upon passage. Technical difficulty has been pointed out by legislative counsel, and so the chair would move that the subcommittee reconsider the vote by which it sent a sending the House Bill 2333 to the full committee. Is there any objection? So ordered. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it's the question raised by council is, since the division is now part of the Department of Human Resources, that it might be better to leave it there for the rest of the current biennium, but give a special emergency clause to the section that appoints the new director so that that part would be effective on passage, so that you would, the Senate would be able to proceed as soon as the bill passes with confirmation.
Mr. Chairman. Senator Hannan.
Mr. Chairman, if we do that, Kay, by putting the emergency clause effective immediately, can we make the emergency clause also apply to the rest of it then on July 1st? Otherwise, if there's no emergency clause on the bill, you're talking about 180 days or something after the session. So I think you'd need that other addition on the report.
That's what I was intending to describe.
Senator Waters, that was my question. You thought the same thing I did.
So it'll be a dual emergency, to be two emergency clauses.
Okay, so the chair moves that House Bill 2333 be further amended to add two emergency clauses. One, making the appointment of the Corrections Department Director effective upon passage, and the rest of the bill effective at the end of the biennium or
July 1
of this year. Objections to that amendment?
That's what the other emergency clause would say. Instead of effective on the passage, it would say effective July 1.
The rest of the bill.
Except for the part about appointing the director. Okay. Objections? Hearing none. So ordered. And then Senator Hannon moves the further amended Senate House Bill 2333 to the full committee with a two-pass recommendation. Objections? Carried. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll open a public hearing on
House Bill 5049.
Open a public hearing on House Bill 5049. Mr. Peer.
Mr. Chairman, Don Peer, Executive Department, Budget Management Division. 5049 is the appropriation bill for special governmental payments. This particular bill covers those types of payments that are of a general claims nature to an entity outside of state government, implementing some legislatively approved purpose. Some of these have been in existence for quite a number of years. There are occasionally individual payments that relate to a single biennium. In the latter category, we have a single biennium appropriation requested. I'd like to provide you with just a summary of the payments that are contained in the governor's recommended budget.
So which governor's budget would this be? Would this be anything like the printed budget?
We are proposing, Mr. Chairman, a revision to the governor's printed budget.
I kind of thought so.
And that revision is to include a $25,000 appropriation to the Constitution Bicentennial. I have submitted to your staff, and I believe you may have copies of several things that we're proposing to the committee in the course of the public hearing and the eventual work session. Just quickly, you've already heard of one, and that is the revision of the governor's budget for the Constitution Bicentennial. We are proposing to you, and again, you have copies of this, supplemental appropriation for the 1985-87 biennium, a $2,000 supplemental appropriation for institutional and volunteer medical small claims. These will be described further. And a $46,000 general fund appropriation for local government workers' compensation, where the state has a legal obligation. Those are 1985-87 supplemental appropriations. We have one further technical adjustment that we'd like to talk to you about later on, and that relates to the Emergency Fire, or otherwise known as Conflagration Act claims, and volunteer medical claims. Here we would, excuse me. Oh, I thought I heard somebody say something.
We didn't do it.
We have the same $15,000 appropriation We would not change the amount, the dollar amount. However, we would propose to you that in the appropriation bill that we redeploy that money so that we would have $6,000 of it available for special district attorney compensation. So we have the revision of the governor's printed budget, two supplemental appropriations for 1985-87, and that one technical adjustment that we'll be talking to you later. I have submitted to you a proposed schedule or agenda for today out of the various and I would I think rather than for me to continue talking, I would think it would be more helpful to you if we started with the Bicentennial Commission and Floyd McKay, executive assistant to the governor, is here this afternoon, and I think we can start at that point if that's satisfactory with you.
Representative Jones.
So that I understand this, are we talking about this $15,000 and the rest of this by any?
The $15,000, Mr. Chairman, Representative Jones, is not for this biennium. That is 87-89. If you're looking down there where the three are combined,
right.
That $15,000 is for 1987-89. The bracket merely identifies those three payments as being included in that $15,000.
But they are at the level that's printed here for the rest of this biennium, and then you're reducing it then down.
That's correct. That is a reduction.
Well,
I might just mention that all of those claims, Mr. Chairman, are essentially, have been in the past, they've been e-board actions. And that is, we come in, dribbling in, one at a time as the claims occur. We attempted to come up with some minimal amount this time that would avoid, at least to some extent, the necessity for coming in. You know, I think that $15,000 for all three of those categories is likely to be very minimal, but it ought to get us quite a ways through the biennium.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hand.
Don, that Conflagration Act, wasn't that chemical spill or fire out in Silverton, and we had all these different programs
there. Yes, there was one in Silverton. We had one up in Redmond area.
Yeah, a fire or something. Yeah. Well, then, if you go 15,000 from what you did in the last biennium, in other words, what you're saying is if it exceeds the 15,000 threshold, you just come back to the E-board.
Would have to come back to the emergency board.
Yeah, that's fine. And so the 85-87 estimate is what you went and obtained from the emergency board?
That's correct.
Yeah. Okay. Representative Jones.
And then on the general fund portion of this, how does it compare then with, I mean, this new one of 87-89, how does it compare with the general fund portion of 85-87? There doesn't appear to be a total down
there. There isn't a total, and I can calculate that for you, Mr. Chairman. I don't have it with me at the moment, but the reason why it doesn't appear on that paper is that there's no corresponding payments. For example, we're not proposing payment to the Kidney Association this time at all. There are several types of payments that were contained in the 1985-87 column that don't appear at all in this one, plus the constitutional bicentennial appears now but doesn't appear in the previous. It was the discontinuation primarily of those one-time or phased-out payments that there isn't. That's easy. We'll put one together for you and give it to you.
Now, the other question, Mr. Chairman, would be is this is an unavoidable situation that we're in as far as the special benefits are concerned?
Mr. Pierre.
I've got a figure for you if I may.
Okay.
The general fund expenditures for special governmental payments for 1985 and 87 are estimated to be $2,505,084.
And in response to Representative Jones' second question,
I'm sorry, I was looking for the number.
Is this really necessary, I think, was the question.
Well, yeah. Is this an unavoidable expense that we have, that we're looking at, or appropriation, or whatever you want to call it?
I think generally speaking, well, first of all, there are few expenses that I know of in government anywhere that are unavoidable. However, I believe that for the most part, they represent policies that you have adopted, the executive has proposed, and you have adopted. For example, I would pull one immediately out, and that's inmate legal services, now handled under contract with Willamette University. There, we're fulfilling an obligation relating to the civil rights of inmates of our penal institutions. This has been, we only now have it under contract with Willamette University. Prior to last September 1, it was a contract with the Inmate Legal Services Corporation. But it's local workers' compensation. That was an obligation imposed on the state by the district attorney or attorney general.
I understand what you're saying, and they appear to be, at least some of them are out of order. I mean, up to a point. Now, I guess the other, well, of course, that's a non-limited amount, but I'm still curious, and went up a little, not a whole lot, but about $100,000.
That non-limited, Mr. Chairman, Representative Jones, the non-limited transit figure down there is strictly a function of the number of people on the payroll in state government.
The employees. And
yes, exactly.
Some, so that's
right.
Automatic.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So we're starting somewhere, where? 100,000 or something?
Well,
we're below what was going to last
there, which is probably caused by.
Mr. Chairman, it's a little bit misleading just to look at the general fund appropriation last biennium, this biennium, because, for example, the governor's budget this biennium doesn't include $750,000 in general fund for the mass transit program. So, you know, you've dropped $750 right there. There are probably only two things which clearly are voluntary on your part on this list, and that's the first two. There's no statutory requirement for assistance to the Constitutional Bicentennial Commission nor to the Civil Air Patrol. The others relate to statutory requirements or mandates or so on. So the first two are probably in the category that you could say these are truly voluntary contributions that the legislature chooses to.
Okay. One last question, Mr. Pierre. Is the bottom line consistent with the request in the governor's printed budget?
The bottom line does include the revision that we've proposed, and that is for the Constitution Bicentennial. In the 1987 governor's recommended budget, barring gremlins in the arithmetic, it should be the printed budget plus the revision for the 25,000.
Okay. Good. Thank you very much. We'll then hear from Floyd McKay, Andrew Vecino, and Judge Crudup. Oh, it's Ed Regazzino. I know you. It's spelled wrong.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the subcommittee. For the record, my name is Floyd McKay. I'm administrative assistant to Governor Goldschmidt. I'm here to support an amendment to House Bill 5049, providing an additional $25,000 in general funds to be appropriated to the executive department for payment to the Oregon Constitutional Bicentennial Commission for educational and commemorative purposes. The General Government Subcommittee of Ways and Means previously reviewed the budget of the Commission. The Governor requested $30,000 and 0.10 FTE for the Commission. The Subcommittee approved the position and the $5,000 associated with it, but deleted the remaining $25,000. Mr. Chairman, we believe we failed to provide the Subcommittee with adequate information to support our request. The hearing came very early in the session, and to be absolutely frank about it, we allowed it to escape our notice while we were getting our act together somewhat up in the on the second floor. As a result, Commission leadership and the Governor's office did not attend the hearing and provided no testimony, and the subcommittee was certainly correct in taking its action. We'll greatly appreciate your consideration of the issue in the context of the budget contained in House Bill 5049. Governor feels very strongly that the Bicentennial Commission should be able to assist in the development of special events that will provide educational material to Oregonians of all ages during the nation's celebration of the Constitution. We'd like to call two events to your attention this afternoon. Judge Charles Crookham, the Commission Chairman, is here to discuss celebration of Oregon's signing of the Constitution and also to update you on other activities of the Commission. Ed Ragazzino of Eugene will share with you a very exciting proposal to make the Constitutional Convention come to life across Oregon through presentation of the musical play 1776. Both of these events will involve a partnership of public and private funds, with private funds paying the large share to sponsor public events that will be educational and encourage Oregonians to observe the Constitutional Bicentennial. The governor will help raise funds to match the appropriation in this bill to provide these events and others that may be approved by Judge Crookham's Citizen Commission. We want Oregonians to join the nation in the celebration of our Constitution. So I want to thank you very much for this special consideration, and Judge Crookham and Mr. Ragazzino will follow me.
Did anyone appear at all before the general government sub?
I don't believe so.
It was, Mr. Chairman, it was just here. Included as an expenditure within, there was no explanation beyond.
Mr. Weeks, what happened?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think I remember Mr. Peer describing the activities, what the money was going to be used for and how it would be used, and the fact that Judge Crookham was spearheading the effort. And so I don't want you to go away with the impression that there wasn't any discussion about this particular request, because there was some good amount of discussion.
I merely respond that when you ask the question, did anybody appear, I could only say just me.
Right. Okay, well, we're getting closer to reality.
It slipped right past us, Mr. Chairman, to be absolutely honest. In the shuffle and furor of that opening period, this is one that got by us. And so we come down with egg on face, hat in hand, to try to make amends.
Okay, thank you very much. Judge Kirk.
I feel like a Fuller Brush man.
Look like one, yeah.
Can I help you?
Yes.
Everybody's one of these.
I'm trying to take my chair away. Yeah. Mr. Thank you.
Yes, you approve of it?
The result. Now, usually when I get materials like this, I think, gee, they've got plenty of money. What are they doing here?
That's the nation.
Oh.
If you'll notice on the back of the calendar, they have the logo that the National has adopted, and that's been modified now, so the bicentennial will run until 91. In the back of the Constitution book is sort of a timeline, and you'll notice the last entry is December 15, 1791, pardon me, when Virginia ratified the Bill of Rights, and so the matter is going through. For the purpose of the record, I'm Charles Crookham. I'm Commission Chairman and a circuit judge in Portland. The commission was created by the governor after the 85 session, and so we were not in the budget, and we've had no money other than, I think Mr. Peer was able to give me $200 postage. I'm in the hole myself about the $400, just trying to keep the thing going and having some additional mailings and attending meetings. The commission has 9 members appointed by the governor, and they serve at his pleasure. And this was as a result of action taken by the National Commission encouraging each of the states to create in one way or another a commission for activities within the state. In the foreword to the Constitution, Justice Berger makes this comment: the principal goal of the National Commission is to stimulate an appreciation and understanding of our national heritage, a history and civics lesson for us all. And this is what we've been directing our activities toward. We've been sponsoring various projects where people have come to us, and through the Oregon Law-related project at Lewis and Clark Law School, we've been working with the State Department of Education in a number of seminars for K through 12 teachers throughout the state. There will be another one this summer, and they've been very successful. What we're seeking is just some help. I don't have any staff, and I can compare this with the bicentennial for the revolution independence. We had full funding by the legislature. We had certain funds that we obtained out of the private sector. And then the federal government gave us block grants to the extent of about $300,000 to sponsor projects around the state. We have none of that this time, and so we really come begging. We even have had such a low profile that we weren't included in the Oregon Blue Book. I'm not recommending that they republish it, but I would at least like to be recognized at some point. Let me tell you of some specific projects that we've been involved in. Magna Carta, of course, the Lincoln exemplar of Magna Carta, came to the Oregon Historical Society and then went on down to Eugene and Jacksonville last summer. That was a project that we encouraged and sponsored, of course, without any funding, and it's been very successful, and now it's about to appear in 100 cities in the East, starting in Washington, and will travel around with the original 13 colonies and the states that came in as a result of the Northwest Ordinance, which is also a bicentennial this summer, because in 87, while the Constitutional Convention was going on, Congress was meeting in New York, and they passed the Northwest Ordinance, which I think we all recognize as one of the more significant bits of legislation. On September 17th, which is the anniversary date of the signing, the final signing in Philadelphia, there will be a large, what I would characterize as a birthday party, sponsored by the Multnomah and Federal Bar Associations in Portland at 12 noon after the pealing of church bells. There'll be this celebration in Pioneer Square in Portland. It's being supported by a number of organizations. The National Guard is supplying us with the color guard and things of that nature. David Douglas High School is going to send a band. Fred Meyer Organization is baking us a huge birthday cake, and we're even praying for good weather. We hope we'll have that, but we have Plan B in case that doesn't work out. February 14th next year will be a designated day in a program being sponsored by Merrill Lynch, and they're encouraging each of the states to have a celebration either the commemorating their ratification of the Constitution if they're one of the 13, or their admission day if they are any of the subsequent 37 states, and that's being planned with the Oregon Historical Society, and there will undoubtedly be some observances here. I'm sorry you're not in session to join it, but the governor's office is fully supportive of this. One other project that is finally off the ground after a lot of arm twisting is something called the Project Constitution, which was put together by some people in Portland. They've had a number of scholars throughout the country who are recognized in the field, including Attorney General Frohmeyer and Justice Gillette, prepare historical resumes of various aspects of the Constitution, and it was their plan to have these then put into a drama form and taped and have as a permanent asset for schools, primarily in Oregon, but they would make them available outside of the state. They received a grant this week from the Murdoch Foundation of over $300,000, and they're working with the PBS station in Philadelphia, and I understand now that they anticipate that their first one-hour tape will be available at the time of September 17th, which is sort of the witching hour. There's some thought that Congress might make that a one-shot national holiday, although I've seen no movement in that direction. So these are the things that are going on. The commission has endorsed these various projects, and the national has encouraged local communities to have their own. So far, these communities around Oregon have responded. Malawa, Clatskanie, Roseburg and Douglas County, Hood River County, Beaverton, Wilsonville, Estacada, Ashland, Hermiston, Yamhill County, Canby and Klamath Falls, and they are doing whatever they want to. They submit a petition to us, and we go over it and then send it on to the national, and they're doing various things in various places, maybe a parade. Malawa with their Buckaroo is dedicating the Buckaroo this summer, July 4th. So those are other aspects, and of course, those don't involve funding. What we would like to have is exactly what's been put in, either to match on projects as they come up, but primarily to have some ability to pay bills. So.
You've been incurring bills without resources with which to pay them?
I've been paying them myself.
You've been personally?
Yes. So, I'm tired of it.
I see.
My wife is too, she says. It has not been of great amounts, but it's kind of frustrating when you want to put out a $15 or $20 mailing to have to dig down. And it's not tax deductible. I haven't figured out how to take that off either.
Yeah. The purpose of the program is primarily historic.
Yes.
Educational.
Educational, essentially.
Some patriotism.
It's a happy blend of all of those.
Okay. Questions? Thank you very much.
Thank
appreciate
you very
you
much
for coming, Mr. Regazzino. If I would have looked up, I would have known who you were.
See, your actor training has served you well.
Old drama instructor.
Not old.
I mean, drama instructor.
Right.
Former.
Former.
My name is Ed Rangasino. I'm the producing director and the vice president of the Eugene Festival of Musical Theater. We are a professional summer theater musical producing company operating in the Holt Center. Along with the Bach Festival, we occupy as resident companies most of the summer. This summer we're producing, as our main offering, 1776, the musical. I'd like to show you a short video, 9 minutes to be exact, that tells you something about the Eugene Festival Musical Theater, and I'll tell you about this proposed tour.
Hit the video. We'd be delighted.